The naysayers and the property pessimists were proven wrong. Despite prolonged lockdowns, no immigration, no international students, the threat of high unemployment and all the pessimistic predictions for our housing markets, the value of many houses around Australia grew by more than 20% in the last year alone. Obviously, we were in unprecedented times over the last couple of years, so we can't really blame some of those who made predictions early in the pandemic for getting it so wrong. But now that it seems we're over the other side, across that bridge that Scott Morrison said he'd built for us a year or two ago, what property lessons can we learn from COVID to make us better property investors moving forward? Well, that's the topic for my chat today with Ken Race, Australia's leading property tax strategist and director of Metropole Wealth Advisory, as we plan to share 20 insights that we've learned during COVID-19 to help us, our clients, and you become better, more successful investors moving forward. So, welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
The last 2 years have been amongst the most tumultuous in living memory, and yet Australia looks to be emerging out of COVID is a much better place than almost any other country, and our property markets have surprised almost every commentator on the upside. So what can we learn from this? To discuss the property lessons that we've learned from COVID, I'm joined today with my business partner, Ken Race, Director of Metropole Wealth Advisory, who's been well recognised as Australia's leading property tax strategist. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Michael.
Now, we speak about these things on a regular basis and have been helping our clients over the years get through COVID, but let's put some context to it all. Despite numerous lockdowns, particularly in our two largest capital cities, our property markets are going to deliver more than 20% capital growth in many locations around Australia. And Sydney, where you live and a lot of our clients are, that's going to, in many suburbs, present even more than 30% capital growth.
That's right. And I think this is one of the first cycles we've had for quite some time where most properties, irrespective of where they were, have increased. Normally, it's the investment grades that have done well.
Very much so. So it's actually been all the suburbs of all the capital cities, other than Perth that's had a few challenges, even regional Australia. But the high rise, the inner city, the CBD apartments haven't done as well because that particular segment was first of all oversupplied and then didn't have the tourists, didn't have the students. But you're right, we've both been investing for combined, close of us both, to 50 years each. So on that basis, we've been through a couple of cycles.
Quite a few cycles.
Haven't we? But one of the lessons, let's go through them, that we've learned. I think what some people learned this time, and I think we've sort of intuitively knew that, was the property market is too big to fail. There are too many vested interests. The governments and the banks, they've got a vested interest. They've invested with us. I mean, for most of the investment properties and for most people's homes, the bank owns as much as the owner does. So they stepped in when things got tough, didn't they?
They certainly did. You know, there's another aspect here for Australia, which is quite salient, is, you know, two-thirds of properties in Australia are owned by owner-occupiers. So they're very, you know, mindful of maintaining their credit ratings, whereas in other parts of the world, it's closer to 50%. So California's at 55%, as an example. You know, if the property market was to fail in Australia, it would hit normal mums and dads living in their homes.
Very much so. I think the other thing is it showed the resilience of our banking system, which is too big to fail, as opposed to overseas where there's some big banks and some small banks. Really, a large part of our banking system is the four big banks, which are well controlled. I use the word they're resilient, but they actually are prudent in their lending criteria as well.
That's right. I mean, we did have a period there where people could borrow, you know, 105%, 10 times their income. but certainly through the GFC, the Banking Royal Commission, through COVID, they've really restricted the amount of money you can borrow, and have also made it harder for investors to borrow by either reducing the amount that banks can lend to investors or by increasing the interest rate that they charge to investors. So the banks are well covered in the amount of capital they retain compared to the loans they make, much more than a lot of other countries around the world.
Now, we said about the banking system being resilient, and I mentioned a moment ago about the housing market. CoreLogic have suggested that our housing market in Australia, which comprises of 10.7 million individual dwellings, has got a value today of $9.3 trillion. It was only about 8 months ago that it was actually $8 trillion. So the property market has grown considerably. And so people are saying, hey, that's unsustainable. But when you look at all the debt against that, and that's not hard to see because the banking system explains that there's currently outstanding mortgage debt of $2 trillion. Now, that's a lot of money. But when you actually look at it, it's a 22, 23% loan-to-value ratio on the whole housing market in Australia. In other words, we know that 50% of homeowners have no debt against their home, and a lot of others have got a lot of equity in their home. So on the one hand, the housing market is in great position, but I think the other, again, the lesson we learned is that the government and the banks are not going to let it fail. They're going to step in if things go wrong.
Correct, because, I mean, you know, mathematics and statistics, averages, you know, don't always paint the accurate picture. So while overall we've got that low loan-to-valuation ratio, we see segments of borrowers, first home borrowers, they're at the 80% plus rate because they're at the beginning of the loan, they haven't started paying down, and then some people moving into the second home who just push up that debt to equity ratio as that starting point. So it's very fragmented, and I think that's what makes it hard for the government to let it fail. It's because the constituents that they're really trying to attract are probably the ones with the higher loans.
There's no doubt that people have bitten off a bit more than they can chew at the moment. But you have to when you first get into the housing market, just like you had 2 years ago, I had 2 years ago. We've spoken about what our first homes were like. And our expectations then were a little bit different from the expectations of a lot of the young people. So I'm going to annoy some younger listeners when I say that it's not always an affordability issue at the moment. Sometimes it's an expectation issue of I want to actually start off in a great position with the sort of home it took my parents 20, 30 years to be able to afford.
That's right. You and I, certainly I started much, much smaller properties and built up, knowing that, you know, by the second, third property, that'll be the one that is probably the longer-term home.
Yes. Now, another lesson that was brought home over COVID was the importance of the supply of money. It's actually not just interest rates. There's no doubt that lower interest rates has made housing more affordable. But you've often heard me say that property investing is a game of money with some houses thrown in the middle. When money's plentiful, when money's cheap, then that fuels our housing market. So that's what the government did last year, didn't it?
It certainly did. And I think we've seen with much lower interest rates, that's probably a bigger impact on house prices than do I have a job and how sustainable is my job? Because there was a lot of focus, you know, with employment levels. That's what pushed up house prices. But it's obviously if you're worried about your future employment, you don't go and buy a home, but cheap money is what's allowed you to retain, if you like, the ability to make the repayments. And just as a simple example, you know, if you borrowed $500,000 at, you know, 10%, your interest rate then is $50,000 a year. If you borrow $1 million today at 2.5%, it's costing you $25,000. And probably my maths was wrong on the if you borrow the first one, but it's you've really got to have a look at how much is that money going out. So it's going to be the supply of money, the interest rates that's going to allow people to maintain their repayments.
Now that there's the suggestion that interest rates are going to slowly rise over the next little while, people are concerned that if lower interest rates are going to fuel the housing market, rising interest rates are going to slow down the housing markets. That's not necessarily the case, because when we look back in previous occasions, rising interest rates didn't instantly slow the market. It was really more the availability to get money and get funds. So I think one of the lessons the government has learned is the importance of the wealth effect. It's an important part of consumer confidence. The government understood that and it wanted to get us through COVID. And with the election coming up, I guess it's going to want us to feel comfortable as well. So I think those who owned assets were benefiting most from government stimulus, but the wealth effect is one of the things that is making us more comfortable. If we read every weekend that auction clearance rates are high and that our house has gone up in value more than our salary has, most Australians are feeling good, Ken.
Yeah, and given that we have such a high proportion of owner-occupiers and, you know, at about two-thirds, 67%, if we assume there's probably 15% of people who aren't ever going to buy a home because they're living here for a couple of years or transient or whatever, we're really talking about a very high proportion of people who could possibly own a home. And therefore, we've got a very large cohort of people who actually feel the wealth effect, as you said.
So the government's actually realised also, I think maybe I'm being naive, but it realised it can spend its way out of a recession. By making people feel wealthy, it will help people spend money, grease the wheels of industry, and that's what happened last year and to a lesser extent this year. So the government intervened. I guess it means that if it's learned how to avoid a recession this time, we should never really have another recession. Now, I bet that's not going to actually happen though, Ken.
No, I don't think so. And certainly a lot of people say they kicked the can down the road. But I think one of the biggest benefits of the government's spending program was it maintained a level of confidence in the economy, and it maintained that relationship between employer and employee so that when the economy did open up again, it was a quicker bounce back.
Yes. I think there's a number of other interesting things that came out of the government incentives. One is, I think last year it was useful to be a government employee, less risk, you get pay rises, more flexible wage negotiations on the one hand. But really, I'm not sure that that's where I'd like to suggest my kids have their careers in the future.
That's right. So, you know, it's a matter of risk. Yes, you might have a job for life. It's, you know, stipulated increases. But the corollary to that, the other side of the coin is, you know, you're probably going to get a slightly lower wage. And we've seen that particularly with, you know, nurses, police, teachers. You know, if there's going to be an increase, you can't increase, you know, the wage to one teacher. It's basically all of them. They've got to just pay what they can afford without it having a massive impact. And any increases by the government in wages to those people, they have to find a way to pay for it, which is predominantly increasing taxes.
Now, interestingly, the Canberra property market was a strong market and I guess a quiet achiever. It doesn't get as much publicity, but the Canberra property market probably was very resilient over the last couple of years because a lot of industries in that territory are reliant on the government, which I guess just kept churning on.
Kept churning on, and probably that was a growth market, you know, with all the government packages, with all the government stimulants. So it was actually a growth sector, and therefore Canberra did do well. I mean, it's always done well, I think, because of high incomes, professional people wanting to live near the embassy districts, the schools. So Canberra's always been expensive because it's had people who could afford to live in those areas and pay more.
Sure. I think one of the other things that came home that we've often spoken about is the importance of the knowledge-based economy in Australia. Those in the knowledge-based economy, those in skill level one and two jobs that we often talk about, which is the areas, the demographics we target to look for investment-grade properties, people who could work from home, I guess work from anywhere, because they sold what was in their head rather than make money using their hands. They could work anywhere and they're likely to continue doing so. So those people did well. In fact, we know that a lot of them became wealthier over the last couple of years, while other segments of industry, tourism, hospitality, retail suffered. So I think one of the lessons here is get a good education because it's going to see you through life, or consider upgrading your skills. And it's also important to invest in those areas. Look at the demographics. Where people have got more knowledge-based jobs, they're less likely to lose their jobs in the future. They're going to be owner-occupiers who are going to buy into those areas, gentrify the areas, make them more valuable, but also some of them are going to be tenants, but they're going to be able to pay higher rent. So demographics has always been important, and it played out well over the last couple of years.
And I think that strong knowledge-based emphasis allows people to slightly change where and what they do because they're more adaptable. And therefore, you know, in businesses, we called it businesses pivoted. You know, the gin manufacturer now made, COVID
hand sanitizers.
But, yeah. People could move from one industry to another because they actually used those skills in a slightly different way where it was needed.
Now, as we work through the lessons that were brought home over COVID, some of these were lessons that you and I have known and seen because we've been through multiple cycles before, but reaffirmed by COVID. But one of the clear ones is you can't rely on one income stream, Ken.
You certainly can't. You need to have multiple income streams. You know, in a non-financial planning sense, can I say you need to insure your income in case of illness or serious injury. So you've got to have backups in life. One of them is, how do I actually pay for my expenses if I lost my job? Do I have enough savings? Do I have a second level of income? Even if it's not directly replaceable, it helps. It takes off the edge.
Sure. I guess it showed people that their jobs aren't secure, and it may not be a pandemic next time. As you said, it could be health or other issues that affect it. So you'll never become wealthy saving. It is important to save. I agree with you. And I guess that's one of the other lessons. You need a cash flow buffer to help see you through. But you and I advocate investing, and you and I advocate investing in real estate. And in general, for many people, it starts with residential real estate. But you can invest in the big companies of the world and invest in shares if you know what you're doing, or invest in superannuation. And this isn't advice because we're not allowed to give superannuation advice, but don't rely on one income stream. And the other lesson, of course, is have a cash flow buffer, Ken.
Absolutely. So when you're borrowing, set aside a little bit of money. And savings, I think we've really got to get into a savings pattern. If you save 10% of your income every year, after 10 years, that's a year's worth of money you've got. So you could afford to be without
work. That's interesting. Work. Hadn't thought about it that way. Yes.
Even at 5%, it gives you half a year. And that really allows you to maybe find another job. Maybe for a lot of people I've seen, accept a slightly lower paying job, but in an area that they enjoy more. So it gives you lots of options.
Now, when we say savings, we don't necessarily say put it in the bank because that's not necessarily going to get you much return, but it could well be in an offset account, Ken.
Correct. And many people forget about the benefits of an offset account. And an offset account is really a second account linked to your loan account. So if you deposit money into that account, when the bank works out your interest expense, they add the two amounts together, a large debt and an amount in the offset account, and then charge you interest on that net amount. And they calculate it daily. So the beauty of the offset account is even if you had money in there for 2 weeks out of four, you still get a benefit.
Now, interestingly, we said don't put it into a savings account, but recently I read that Australians are hoarding $75 billion worth of cash. Let me explain. The total value of all Australian banknotes has doubled in a decade and is up 20% since the start of the pandemic. And apparently that's because more Australians are hoarding cash, I don't know, under their mattresses or wherever. I guess it was maybe a feeling of insecurity in the future. So despite the rise of credit card payments, which means that less cash is being used in the shops, according to the Reserve Bank, the surge in banknotes has been apparent by people just interested in storing their wealth in paper money rather than elsewhere. Now, I'm not sure that's a good investment way of doing things, but I thought that was fascinating. $75 billion worth of cash hoarded somewhere.
I was surprised because money in a normal bank account, you know, you can get it 24 hours just by going to an ATM machine. You can transfer. I think, you know, the adage that the bank is going to fail and I'm going to lose my deposits, that's, you know, 1930 depression type talk. I don't think that's going to happen, but something got into people's minds, and a lot of them, is to actually keep cash as opposed to, you know, keeping it in a safer place. I mean, I'd always be scared about being robbed.
I agree with that. So it's interesting how emotions drive financial decisions, and rational people don't necessarily do rational things when it comes to money. So how do you get rid of these emotions? How do you make yourself less emotional? How do you have a better sleep at night factor? And I think one of the lessons is it's important to get a level of financial security, get some assets behind you. Now, that's hard when you start, but it's a journey, it's a process, and you've got to start earlier.
It's amazing. It's all about educating yourself, finding out who can help you. And talking to a lot of, can I say, younger clients, I talked to them and they had a period of time where they saved money for the deposit on their home. And they saved quite rigidly. But now when they buy the home, they've stopped saving and they actually start spending on other things. They don't maintain that savings level that could then allow them to get into a second property, invest in other asset classes, create a buffer. So it's almost like the weight of the world's off their shoulders because they bought that first property and they forget the lessons of the value of growing an asset base.
Sure. So it's important to build, some people used to call it a nest egg, and so you've got to have assets. And superannuation is no doubt an asset, so it's a good way of investing for your long-term future, but it's actually not a liquid asset. So I think it's also important to have an element of liquid assets. So if somebody tells you shares only, run away, or if somebody talks just property and you don't need anything else, be very careful because they've got probably a vested interest. So it's nice to actually have assets that you can fall back on, whether it's money sitting in an offset account or liquid assets such as shares. I'm not even going to mention Bitcoin because at this point, Ken, I don't think it's an asset. It's, in my mind, speculative, but you'd probably know a bit more about it than I would.
It's amazing. I mean, there's some banks now that are accepting Bitcoin as security for loans. Commonwealth Bank, you know, has put it on their platform. You know, some countries, you know, are accepting it as coinage. It's like technology is ahead of the law. And there's a large group of people who are uncomfortable with governments and their financial systems. And this allows them a backdoor into being able to pay for things, save for things. You never see anything. I mean, I won't talk about what I think about the nefarious activities of some people with Bitcoin, but let's leave that when we do the X-rated podcast. But I need something a bit more substantial. But there is a very large proportion of people where Bitcoin now is part and parcel.
Oh, I think when we look at the situation in 10 years' time, it'll be more a part, whether it's Bitcoin or cryptocurrency of some
sort. Crypto, we should have called it cryptocurrency.
I guess so. So the bottom line is, in this particular point I'm making about the lessons one should have taken out of COVID, is that you need a level of financial security, financial assets, to give you the sleep at night factor so you don't make emotional decisions, knee-jerk reactions. Because if you lose your job or if you're worried about your mortgage payments, unfortunately, you don't always make smart decisions. And there will be another crisis, Ken. Look, I don't know whether it's going to be a pandemic. There's always minor X factors and then there are bigger factors. But we're going to have another recession at some time. I don't know when it is. We're going to have a depression again, possibly one day. There's high level of certainty that uncertainty is going to be with us for a long time. So therefore, have a bit of a backup. And I guess having a diversity of your assets puts you in a much better position. And if you haven't started, hopefully just listening to Ken and me, two old guys talk, is going to give you the impetus to start today.
Yeah, so, you know, we want a level of certainty if we need to tap into these funds. So people need to really distinguish between, are they investing or are they speculating? You should only speculate with the funds you could actually afford to lose without making an indent on you. And it's really, you know, looking at investment grade assets, which is going to be where you tap into in cases of emergency.
Now, what we're doing, Ken, is working through the property lessons that we learned from COVID. And we made a couple of bullet points to have a chat about this, and we're not even halfway through. So there's one big one I want to discuss today, Ken, and then let's get back together again real soon to do a follow-on podcast from this, because, boy, were there a lot of good lessons that we hope that just by talking about them and bringing some clarity means that our listeners are going to be better investors, better business people moving forward. Now, Ken, before we go on to this last big one I want to discuss with you at the moment, people would recognize that your role at Metropole is being a director of Metropole Wealth Advisory, but what is it actually that you do day to day?
Yeah, good question. So, I mean, in a nutshell, it's helping people grow, protect, and pass on their assets. So one of the things we've learned over time, or I've learned over time, is that people need assistance to bring together the expertise of various professionals, their accountant, their lawyer, their financial planner, and no one ever does that. So therefore, there's big gaps in how people do things, and they end up money falling through the cracks, so to speak.
I guess it's because each of those disciplines speaks a different language, Ken. People try and join the dots and they can't.
Yeah, so we join the dots, as you said, but more than that, because if it was easy to join the dots, smart people could do it. It's you don't see where the dots are sometimes. So it's creating these bridges of what you should be doing compared to what you're doing. So we help people fix up any errors and mistakes that they've been into. We help then produce better ways to do things in the future and therefore improve. And we look at a whole series of issues from tax to structuring to trusts to business ownerships to estate planning to risk management. So that way you know that you've got a plan for your wealth creation that takes into account all the individual aspects. And you've got someone, as you said, Michael, who speaks the lingos of those individual people. So you actually can convert a recommendation into an outcome. So you execute correctly for the outcome that you want. And that's what we help people do.
So as part of the holistic approach at Metropole, Ken's team at Metropole Wealth Advisory give the wealth advice, and they work hand in glove with the property strategist, the finance, the financial planning team. If you'd like to actually do well moving forward, if you'd like some clarity, some direction, some certainty, go to metropole.com.au, find out about what we do. And what we don't do is sell property, but we put a strategic plan together for you to help you grow your wealth. Go to metropole.com.au, leave us your details, and why not have a chat with Ken to see if he and his team can help you. Now, Ken, one last big one I'd like to discuss in this particular show, and then we've got to come back again, well, in the next podcast and discuss the others, is I think it's going to be important to expect the markets to correct. They didn't correct a lot last year, but interestingly, I remember on my podcast, in my blogs, in my videos, I actually made some predictions in March last year, 2020, and they were pretty accurate. And the predictions were that A-grade homes and investment-grade properties would probably fall about 5%, and B-grade properties would probably fall in value by maybe around 10% during COVID, and C-grade properties, the ones that nobody wanted, they'd be really, really hard to sell. And that sort of played out. And then in October 2020, the market turned and we thought we got through COVID. We didn't really, but it went on again. And the markets have been particularly strong. And moving forward, the markets will correct themselves again. Look, big corrections occur. I know every cycles occur every 8 to 12 years. I think this is going to be a shorter cycle this time round, Ken, because it's all been brought forward very quickly. The bottom stage of that property clock, where things just slowly start to pick up, we've missed that part of the cycle. It went straight into boom, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think part of the reason is we were coming out of that cycle when COVID hit. So there was this artificial suppression. So there was that pent-up demand for activity that once the economy started looking like opening, once we started getting vaccination rates up, people actually then went out and invested. The banks, yes, have some restrictions in lending. What they do is they add an interest rate buffer of 3% to the interest rate to make sure you can afford it. And then that makes sure that they're not over-lending. So I think there was that pent-up demand, which is why I think it seems to be a shorter upward cycle. It's really we're squashing into a few years what would have normally taken 4 years. And it's like the athlete. You go into your marathon run. At the end, you need a bit of a rest till you do the next one. So it's either the market itself has a bit of a rest, or the governments impose a rest if they see it overheating. And, you know, people say the market can't continue at 20% and we've got to do something. Well, it's never continued at 20%, so we shouldn't expect it to do that. But there will be periods every cycle of very high growth, leveling, a bit of negative. So you've got to be in there for the whole cycle to get the average.
I think it's a really good point. I think the minimum time you've got to be in property is a decade or 10 years. That's short-term investing. You really should be in it for 20 to 30 years. So people are asking, well, what's your forecast, Michael? What's the forecast for 2022? And I think I'm disappointing them because I say I don't do forecasts. I have expectations. I expect there's going to be another recession in the next decade, but I don't know when it's going to come. I expect the property market's going to continue on doing well for a while. Then prices, as you say, they'll flatten. And in fact, in some areas, they're going to tumble. But I don't know when that's going to be. And I expect some of the investments I make will do better than others. And I'm not always sure which they are. I expect interest rates are going to rise, probably not for several years. In fact, I don't know when. I expect another world financial crisis, but I've got no idea when. Now, these aren't contradictions. They're not a form of cop-out. People say, oh, but you meant to know this. No, there's a big difference, Ken, in my mind, between expectations and forecast. An expectation is the anticipation of how things are likely to play out in the future, based on my own perspective of how it's worked in the past. Forecasts are actually putting a time frame on that expectation. Of course, in an ideal world, you'd like to be able to forecast. You want to know what's ahead, but we can't. There are just too many moving parts. So I guess the bottom line lesson for this is don't even try and time the market, Ken.
So I think we've got to plan for the unexpected and hope it doesn't happen. But if it does, you've got a fallback position. So we don't always hope for the best. We should plan for the unexpected.
I think that's really important because if you expect the unexpected, you won't be disappointed when it happens. Well, Ken, there's lots more lessons we've gleaned from COVID, property lessons, financial lessons, investment lessons. So I'd like to reconvene real soon in our next episode of the Michael Yardney podcast and go through those with you. So look forward to catching up with you again real soon, Ken.
Sounds great, Michael. Thank you.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In today's mindset moment, I'd like to share a message I learned from one of my mentors, Jim Rohn, who explained, if you can change yourself, you can change your life. What Jim Rohn said is life is about constant, predictable patterns of change. And the only constant factor will be our feelings and our attitudes towards life. He said, We as human beings have the power of attitude, and that attitude determines choices, and the choices determine our results. All that we are and all that we can become has indeed been left up to us to decide and interpret through our attitudes and our choices. Jim Rohn said, life is like the changing seasons. You can't change the seasons, but you can change yourself. So the first major lesson in life is to learn how to handle the winters. They come regularly, right after autumn. Some are long, some are short. Some are difficult, some are easy. But they always come right after autumn. And that's never going to change. Jim Rohn said, there are all kinds of winters. The winter when you can't figure it out. The winter when everything goes awry. There are economic winters, social winters, and personal winters. Winter times can bring disappointment, and disappointment is common to all of us. So you must learn how to handle winters. You must learn how to handle difficulty, because it always comes after opportunity. That's never going to change. The big question is what to do about winters. Jim Rohn said you can't rid January simply by tearing it off the calendar. Of course, he was talking about the American winters there. So he said you can't just tear it out of the calendar, but here's what you can do. You can get stronger. You can get wiser. You can get better. Remember that trio of words. Stronger, wiser, better. The winters won't change, but you can. Before I understood this, I used to wish that it was summer when it was winter. When things were difficult, I wished they were easy. I didn't know any better. But then my mentor gave me the answer as part of his unique philosophy when he said, don't wish it were easier. Wish you were better. Don't wish for fewer problems. Wish for more skills. Don't wish for less challenge. Wish for more wisdom. So the bottom line is, if you can change yourself, you can change your life. Well, Ken and I didn't get through our 20 insights that I said at the beginning of this show we were going to get through. So we'll be back in the next episode of the Michael Yardney podcast to share further insights, further property lessons that we've learned from the last year or two in COVID to make us all better investors moving forward. But if you got some benefit from today's show, well, first of all, look forward to next week's show, but more importantly, help somebody else who would have also got some benefit from learning these lessons. Why not tell somebody about the Michael Yardney podcast? Just tell one person. That would be a real favour to me and would help spread the word, because my aim is to make as many people as financially fluent as possible, as good investors as possible. So let's spread the word. Of course, you can always leave a review on whatever platform you listen to this show on. I'll be back again real soon, but you can catch me in between these shows on social media. Just look for Michael Yardney, or why not join my private Facebook group? Go to the Property Update private Facebook group, and you'll get something from me every day, a new snippet of information I don't leave elsewhere. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?